Please forgive me for purging myself of a moment of irritation brought on not by anything here, but by a paragraph I read this morning on the sports page, where I find the trivialization of God continuing in America. I read that one college wins over another college by 1 point because the coach solemnly tells us this college is a special place. I believe the school is blessed. His quarterback chimes in, "There's definitely somebody looking out for us. There's somebody on our side." Now, I know I should grin and bear remarks as inane as that, but I visit hospitals, and it's hard for me to read that God makes the ball bounce right for a football team when thousands of children are dying around the world this morning while their parents watch in anguish, and God does not intervene. I decided this morning that someday, if you remember me for no other reason, please remember me as a man who absolutely hated all the selfish ways in which we put God on our side and make him trivial. And that is the end of this moment of exasperation. I need to explain, if you are a visitor today, that we have been talking about the Reformation movement, out of which came Protestant churches like this one. We've talked about how bad things were with the 15th century church and about Martin Luther, who led the German effort to reform it. And today we talk about the Reformation movement in Switzerland, dominated by John Calvin, a man so obsessed with God that he often forgot mercy for mere mortals, a grim logician and maker of laws who both blessed and cursed us, but in my view, cursed us more. I stood in a city park in Geneva a few weeks ago looking up at the great Reformation monument and marveling at the degree to which John Calvin, trying to reform Christianity, deformed it. I am in total agreement with the scholar who says of Calvin that we shall always find it hard to love the man who darkened the human soul with the most absurd and blasphemous conception of God in all the long history of nonsense. But if we cannot love him, we also cannot ignore him, because he left a legacy in Protestant churches in America which still distorts the religion of Christ. Calvin joined the Reformation movement in his native France when he read some of Martin Luther's sermons. But he soon found that his king, Francis I, was not ready for that kind of change and had to flee to Switzerland in order to stay out of prison. At 26, in Basel, this brilliantly educated young man wrote one of the most eloquent, logical, influential, and terrible works in all the literature of religion. book commonly known as The Institutes, sometimes by a longer title, The Principles of the Christian Religion. When he translated it from his excellent Latin into French, it became one of the masterpieces of French prose. In our language, this is how Calvin described humanity. The mind of man is so completely alienated from the righteousness of God that it desires and undertakes everything that is perverse, base, and impure. His heart is so thoroughly infected by the poison of sin that it cannot produce anything but what is corrupt. And if at any time men do anything apparently good, yet the mind always remains involved in hypocrisy and deceit, and the heart enslaved by its inward perversity. You had no idea you were like that. If we are that depraved, we could never deserve happiness in heaven. But Calvin took care of that. His God, for inscrutable reasons, chose even before creation that some of us were to be saved and the rest of us were to be damned. Calvin admitted that this doctrine of predestination was repulsive to human reason, but he accepted it and became the distant father of people like New England's Jonathan Edwards, whose sermon about sinners in the hands of an angry God drove people to despair and suicide. People looked feverishly for some sign that they were one of the chosen. And when they found it, they also found strength to endure almost any hardship life could offer. This earthly life is, after all, Calvin taught them, a veil of misery and tears. The only crucial task we have is to live so carefully that we will be able to escape the torments of hell and be admitted into heaven, a place Calvin described irresistibly in some of the most elegant prose ever written about the afterlife. He said people were right who had written that the greatest of all blessings was not to be born, and the next greatest was to die at once. Only one thing, he thought, could make life bearable, and that was the hope of eternal happiness after death. For the poor and unlucky who covered the earth, it was an indispensable and comforting belief. Calvin was shocked when he got to Geneva by its wickedness, and he set out to create a church-controlled state which would mandate the kind of behavior he wanted. The Great Council of Geneva, awed by Calvin, ordered all citizens to go to church on Sunday and behave during the week or be exiled. Any remnant of the Catholic faith was forbidden. One was not to carry a rosary, cherish a sacred relic, observe a saint's day. Women were put in prison, I say for the benefit of one especially in this church, for wearing alluring hats. Gamblers were put in the stocks. Adulterers were driven through the streets into banishment. If you are thinking shades of New England, you are right. Because some of Calvinism came to New England with the Puritans and the Pilgrims. Calvin's first try at turning a whole city and state into a church was too much for fun-loving Geneva. And when a new council came into power, he and his friends were driven away. He went to Strasbourg, preached there for a while, and during that time found it inconvenient to be a bachelor any longer, and asked his friends to find a wife for him. He listed the specifications. He said, "I am none of those insane lovers who, when once smitten with the fine figure of a woman, embrace also her faults. This only is the beauty which allures me, that she be chaste, obliging, not fastidious, economical, patient, and careful for my health." When the woman who accepted these terms became his wife, he may have been kinder than his list makes him sound. When she died after 9 years, he wrote about her with great tenderness and lived alone the rest of his life. Hearing that the city of Geneva might be on the verge of returning to Catholicism, Calvin wrote a magnificent letter to the cardinal who was trying to save the city for Rome. Martin Luther, reading that letter back in Wittenberg, hailed it as a total annihilation of the Pope's representative. "I rejoice," Luther said, "that God raises up men who will finish the war against Antichrist, which I began." I should probably interject at this point that one of the sad features of Protestant history begins very soon after Luther had praised Calvin, because the two of them split and their followers formed two different churches. The Geneva Council was so impressed by Calvin's letter and so concerned about how Geneva had sunk into even looser living since Calvin left, that it invited him back. And when he came back this time, he set out with furious passion to create the city of God on the shores of Lake Leman, sleeping very little, eating less, working 16 and 18 hour days. The power and intensity inside his frail physical body amazed everyone who met him. He drew up a new ecclesiastical code under which preachers became more powerful than the priests and bishops Calvin had wanted to put out of business. The law of a Christian state, Calvin said, is the Bible. The clergy are the proper interpreters of that law. Civil government must therefore enforce the Bible as the preachers interpret it. If that doesn't make your skin crawl, you've stopped listening. The consistory, or presbytery, set up by Calvin, ran the city, told everybody how to worship, and sent a minister and an elder to visit each family once a year, questioning the household on all phases of its life. If the presbytery banished a person from church for some minor offense, the city council was to banish that person from town. The religious dictatorship said that church attendance on Sunday is mandatory, a feature I secretly like, as it is also on weekdays whenever there is preaching, and that if anyone came late to the sermon, that person should be first warned and then fined. Protestantism under Luther had been based on the right of private judgment, but Calvin completely repudiated that idea and became a Protestant pope. Heresy, as it had been in the Catholic Church, much to the annoyance of Protestant reformers, once again became an insult to God and treason to the state, and was to be punished by death. In about 20 of those heady years, 58 persons were put to death, 76 were banished, hundreds were fined and otherwise punished. Witchcraft was a capital crime. In 1 year, on the advice of Calvin's presbytery, 14 alleged witches were sent to the stake on the charge that they had persuaded Satan to afflict the city of Geneva with the plague. Religion intruded everywhere into life. The church told people how to dress, how many dishes could be served at a meal, how bad it was to wear lace or jewelry, put a woman in jail for arranging her hair too high on her head. Proper punishment for the beehive, probably. Theater was banished except for religious topics, and then even those were forbidden. Children were not to be named anymore after saints in the Catholic calendar, which had been a common practice before the Reformation. They were to be named after Old Testament characters. One stubborn father served 4 days in jail for insisting on naming his son Claude instead of Abraham. To speak disrespectfully of Calvin or the clergy was a crime. And apparently, in one extraordinary instance, a child was beheaded for striking its parents. Well, why, you ask, would people put up with this kind of thing? And the answer is that for all his severity, Calvin gave them something. He turned Geneva into a city of hard work, sobriety, remarkable frugality, and thrift. An eyewitness from Italy who found refuge as a Protestant in Geneva wrote, and these are his exact words, that cursing and swearing, unchastity, sacrilege, adultery, and impure living, such as prevail in many places where I have lived, are here unknown. There are no pimps and harlots. The people do not know what rouge is, and they are all clad in seemly fashion. Benevolence is so great that the poor need not beg. Lawsuits are banished from the city. I suddenly thought of all the attorneys we have in this church. There are no organs here. No voice of bells. No burning candles or lamps in the churches. No relics, pictures, statues, canopies, or splendid robes. The churches are quite free from idolatry. This is what the somber mystic, with his thin little black beard, high forehead, penetrating, ruthless eyes, had done. With a mind that burned like the sun and a will that was indomitable. I have painted a dark picture, and it is accurate. But there was, of course, another side, or we would never have had such influence. It's true that he had no sense of humor, or he would have forgiven human weakness more readily, and that he had no sense of beauty, or he would not have stripped the cathedrals quite so bare. But he did encourage his followers to be cheerful, to play harmless games like bowling, and even to enjoy wine in moderation. He could be a kind and tender friend, but he was an absolutely unforgiving enemy. Those who knew him best said and wrote that they found much to love and admire in Calvin. He was as totally unselfish as a human being can be. In fact, Pope Pius IV, who had no reason to be fond of Calvin, said of him, "The strength of that heretic consisted in this, that money never had the slightest charm for him. If I had such servants, my dominion would extend from sea to sea." But Calvin's mind was nothing like Christ's, who said of his enemies, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Calvin found a note in his pulpit one day that called him a hypocrite and warned him to leave or die. A man was arrested for this defiance on extremely scanty evidence, tortured twice a day for 30 days, and confessed, perhaps only to end the persecution. A few hours later, half dead already, he was tied to a stake, his feet nailed to it, and his head was cut off. A fellow Protestant of Calvin's, with whom he had once been on friendly terms, a man by the name of Michael Servetus, probably a little unbalanced mentally, was sentenced to die for writing heresy against Calvin's theology. He begged for mercy. Calvin refused. He asked to be beheaded rather than be burned alive. Calvin considered it, but one of his aides, whose statue is also in the park in Geneva, rebuked him for being so tolerant, and the sentence was carried out. Servetus was fastened to a stake by iron chains, with his latest book of heresy bound to his side. When the flames reached his face, he shrieked with agony, and after half an hour of burning, he was dead. He had disagreed with Calvin and his disciples over the interpretation of Scripture. How strange it is, because good and evil are forever inextricably mixed, that despite this horrible side of Calvinism, his stress on schooling and hard work, on discipline and public morality, helped all over Europe and in England to break the power of kings and make democracy possible. His theory of predestination died out in this country as people grew proud of their own work, felt more secure about their own worth, and developed a more humane vision of a God not as cruel as the one Calvin worshipped. Those of us, and there are some of us in this room, who grew up in churches where dancing was wrong, even a high school prom, and movies were sinful, and God was an all-seeing eye watching you, and hell was a constant threat, we know the joy of turning from law to grace, from the fierce and vengeful God of the Old Testament, Calvin's God, to the God of Jesus. And to us, having found our way out of that darkness, it is hard to hear the name of John Calvin without a shudder. Next week, we'll follow the Reformation across the English Channel and trace the religious journey from King Henry VIII to our own ancestors, the Congregationalists. Please come back and think about those things.